Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and we continue going through our favorite 100 movies of all time. Today, we're talking about number 37, and that's Ordinary People for myself, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for John, another episode where I am going to be very happy because I get to talk about two movies that appeared on my list. I had Once Upon a Time in Hollywood pretty far down on the list. Still came in the top 100. It was somewhere in like the 80s. I want to say it was like 86 or 85, something like that. You have it in here way up higher, number 37. One of the most recent movies you have on your list. If not the most recent, I'd have to, you know, nitpick when this came out compared to The Lighthouse, I guess. Right? Because those are your two only 2019 movies. You don't have anything. I don't think we could have done anything from 2020. And Parasite, okay.
As well, but I believe technically The Lighthouse did come out later in the year than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, so I believe it's my second newest film on my list.
Got it. Okay, well, we're talking about that one. We're talking about Ordinary People. Ordinary People, the movie that defeated Raging Bull for Best Picture in 1980. One of the most controversial Best Picture wins because it beat Raging Bull. Robert Redford defeated Martin Scorsese, which a lot of people felt Robert Redford just kind of won it as a Lifetime Achievement Award. Timothy Hutton got thrown into supporting actor for this movie, mainly so that he could win because they knew he wasn't going to beat De Niro. So he ends up taking an Oscar away, probably from either Judd Hirsch or Joe Pesci, one or the other. And Mary Tyler Moore doesn't win and, you know, loses to Coal Miner's Daughter, Sissy Spacek. A lot going on with this movie when it came to Oscars, and coming on the heels of another family drama, defeating a huge epic. Which, and not that Raging Bull's an epic necessarily, but we had Kramer versus Kramer defeat Apocalypse Now just 1 year earlier. This movie always disregarded by normal moviegoers, and I'm so happy that I sat down and watched this. You see my list littered with movies like this, whether it be Ordinary People, Shakespeare in Love, Crash. These aren't movies that I'm liking because I want to be opposite. It's just amazing how much these movies connect with me, and 100% certainty. If I was voting in those Oscars, I'm probably voting for those movies to win, that the ones that actually ended up winning. So I just think it's funny to like look back on that and see movies that are not well received, not necessarily not well received, but just talked about in such a negative light. But and yes, we're starting with Ordinary People. There's no reason to even talk about this because Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is obviously more popular. So we're just getting into this, and I'll get to John. But with Ordinary People, what I always found fascinating is when I was in film school, this movie always came up amongst older professors. Always. Now, I hadn't seen this movie when I was in college. I didn't see this. I think the first time I saw it was like my junior year of college, and I watched it again a couple years later and whatever. But the reason I watched it in college is because everybody talked about it. Now, I'm growing up in New Jersey with a dad who likes movies, who thinks that The Godfather is the greatest thing ever made, and you can't argue that with him. Joel Grey is the worst actor ever. I talked about this when we did Cabaret. But the thing was, it was always assumed Raging Bull is a masterpiece. Ordinary People should have never beaten it. It's okay. You know, and that's the way it was always discussed. When AFI was coming out with their top 100 list, Ordinary People was never on them, nothing like that. Here's what I will say about Ordinary People. And I went and watched it because all these old people always said how great it was and that people our age never watched it. And I was like, F you, I'm going to go watch it. Here's what I'll say about Ordinary People. Martin Scorsese, one of the greatest directors of all time. Not necessarily my cup of tea. For the most part, as I've gotten older, I've definitely grown less appreciative of Martin Scorsese. Quentin Tarantino, one of the greatest directors of all time. No doubt about it, who we're going to be talking about in just a few moments. Neither one of them could make this movie. They couldn't do it. Robert Redford could study Quentin Tarantino and could study Martin Scorsese and make something similar to what they made. Neither one of them could make this movie. It's not possible. They could not do it. And I think that is what is so incredible about Ordinary People. This movie is about every little moment and not the big ones. The big one is completely ignored and disregarded for almost 100% of the movie. There is no Hollywoodization of the suicide. There's no Hollywoodization of the accident. There's no Hollywoodization of the parents fighting. We just see the raw moments, and I don't know how they were able to get this to come across as well as it did. This movie is one that has always stuck with me. Every time I watch it, I feel like I find myself connecting a little bit more with each character as you get older and you start to see this. And it's just a devastating, absolutely devastating portrayal of American life when faced with tragedy. And it's any life, but this is based on American. This is American Beauty, the sad version. Like, that's how I always look at this movie. Like, this is American Beauty is like the more fun. We're getting out there. You know, there's all the, I'm going to hit on a high school girl, whatever. And this is the, okay, it's the same premise. Wealthy, well-to-do family. And tragedy hits everybody. And when it hits, your money can't replace that no matter what. This movie's devastating. It's brutal. And John, your first time watching, I saw you gave it 4.5. That makes me happy. But I don't think this movie made you very happy.
No, this was a really tough movie for me to watch. And a lot of it comes down to the fact, like, this hit me emotionally in ways that, like, most movies, you can only hope hit you emotionally. 3 years ago, I lost my sister to suicide, and watching this family just dealing with that type of loss, dealing with attempted suicide as well from, like, their other son and everything, this movie just hit really close to home. And I wasn't quite prepared for it. Like, I had seen what the movie was about. Like, I had the gist of what the movie was about. I wasn't prepared to be sitting there while watching it and just feeling like this existential dread the entire time while still being so fascinated by how human every single performance in this movie is. And that's really what it came down to, is like, despite the fact that this is a hard film for me to get to based on the subject matter, it's one that I definitely am going to have to revisit because it is an exceptional film.
Yeah, this is an interesting one for me because when people always talk about, like, what's the most depressing movie ever, you always go to, like, something that involves, like, a tragedy. You know, we were talking about The Pianist last week. We, you know, you had a movie like Schindler's List. You get these Holocaust movies. Those are massive. You get, like, an Amistad or something along those lines, 12 Years a Slave, very depressing movie. Or people will go into, like, romantic movies. Lost in Translation is a very melancholy movie. Blue Valentine's a very depressing movie. Like, throughout, it just permeates. Yeah. But what's so interesting about this movie is I felt this is a movie that will make you cry numerous times and you don't really know why. There's no big moment. Like, I always say with Crash, when the little girl gets shot, that scene has hit me every time over the last 17 years of my life that I've watched this movie. I cried when I watched that when I was 13. I cried when I watched that 10 weeks ago, or 20 weeks ago, whatever the hell it was, when we did Crash. Yeah. I know what is making me cry in that moment. You know, and I'm not being manipulated, but I know what is doing that. I know what's hitting. I know when Lost in Translation ends, I know what's making me depressed at the end of that movie. I know what's the heaviness or Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I know that. With this movie, there's so many scenes where you're just like, oh God, I'm so emotional. And you don't really know why. There's no big thing happening. Just him talking, Timothy Hutton talking to Judd Hirsch. Donald Sutherland sitting at the table with Timothy Hutton while Mary Tyler Moore is walking over to the side. Like, those moments are so powerful and you can't really describe why they're so powerful. And I said to you earlier, I think the most brilliant thing about this movie is they set it up like a horror movie. It is set up at the beginning. You don't know what happened. You just know something happened and something is off. And we're following this kid. There's almost no music the entire movie. They just keep using canon the entire time. And it just keeps going and going. And you're like, okay, what happened? Why does his mother hate him? Why can he not talk to his mother? Why is his father pushing so hard? It just works so incredibly well because at the end of the day, they're living a horror. They're living a horror story. This is a horror story. This is Hereditary without the supernatural. This is a horror story. And that's just what elevates this movie for me. You don't know why you're crying, and yet you're terrified at the beginning of this movie because you're like, what happened to these people? The name of the movie is Ordinary People. This could happen to anybody. There is nothing special about anybody in this movie.
That's the big thing that really hits home in this movie, is that every single one of these characters, whether it be Timothy Hutton's or any of the, like, core family, they're all so ordinary. And, like, that's the important thing. Like, yes, they're you know, upper middle class to upper class citizens and everything, but they're just regular people. And that is part of what makes this film so hard-hitting, is they just seem like this middle class American family who has been hit by this tragedy, and everything feels off. that because there are none of these very large moments, these moments that like, you know, the emotional tearjerk moments and where you just kind of like find yourself sitting there crying because of like general emotion in this film instead, it's because that's exactly what going through this is like. When you experience a tragic loss like this, it comes in waves. And that's exactly how this film goes. Every moment, it's like at any moment now, any of these characters can break down. You and the audience can break down. And that's because Robert Redford and this cast just completely capture the essence of tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I got two things for this. So one, I think it's fascinating. This movie came out in 1980 and it's so much about therapy and mental health and mental help and all that, which this was not an era where this was happening. Yes, it was starting to become, so it wasn't the 50s or the 60s where it was like, I'm just going to smoke cigarettes, drink alcohol and go sleep with whoever. And then I'll feel better. This was clearly something different than that, but it's still resonating 42 years later. And I think a masterful depiction of this. But the second thing is, I always say this with American Beauty, because it's up, it's my number two. Sometimes it's my number one. It kind of depends on my mood. That and The Deer Hunter, just my mood. And I always say with that movie, I get really frustrated and people say, oh, it's just about male, white, straight problems. Like it's about like middle-class family, white people problems. Yeah, that's what it's about. Like that is what it's about. And Moonlight's not about that. But that doesn't mean that one has more merit than the other. Mm-hmm. What I think is interesting about a movie like Ordinary People, though, that American Beauty doesn't get into, is this movie shows how difficult it is to actually be well-to-do, rich, going to these parties with all these people who have no freaking clue what it's like to actually deal with anything. These people would be better off if it was like a Manchester by the Sea situation where it's rugged and everybody gets it because you've all been through the hardship. Mary Tyler Moore gets so angry at her husband for saying that Timothy Hutton's going to therapy. That drives her crazy because he's telling that to these other affluent people. And I love that scene where it's just bouncing around from pointless conversation to pointless conversation. It's the same conversations that happen now. None of it has changed, but there's nobody to connect with. And I think it was a brilliant decision by Redford and by the writer, which by the way, I have to look this up because it's criminal to not give this writer the credit that they deserve because they wrote one of the greatest screenplays of all time. In my opinion, it's Alvin Sargent. I always forget that it's Alvin. I always want to say Alex, but Alvin Sargent wrote the script. And you know, he also wrote Spider-Man too. So there you go. But Alvin Sargent's decision to not give the parents anybody to latch onto is brilliant because so many times in these movies, we see them go to, you know, they're going to either like a help group, you know, oh, I've lost a kid and now I need somebody to talk to. Oh, we'll talk after. And they go the simple route. They go the route of, you know, adultery, or they go the route of, you know, I'm just going to disappear or something like that. This movie doesn't do that. This is how I always say with all the other movies that I have on this list and everything, they all go there. They all go beyond what we want to do. My graduate example, we all think about the hot lady down the street. We're going to sleep with her. That movie goes there. This movie doesn't go there. This movie just keeps it so real and so level the entire time that it elevates it because Donald Sutherland has nobody to go to. Mary Tyler Moore has nobody to go to. Timothy Hutton has somebody to go to because he has Karen. He has his friends, air quotes, and he has Judd Hirsch. Everybody wants him to go see Judd Hirsch, but why would the adults go see Judd Hirsch? They already know how to deal with problems. No, they don't. And when does Donald Sutherland start to realize all these things about his life and about his wife and about himself and about his kid and about the situation? Once he starts to go see Judd Hirsch. And I just think like forcing them into that. And Mary Tyler Moore never gets better because you can only pretend for so long. You can only pretend for so long. And they don't have a massive blow up. Yeah. He says, I don't think I love you anymore. I don't know what to do with that. And she just leaves because she doesn't know what to do. That's what sets this apart. There's no manufactured drama in this movie. All of it is real. Mm-hmm. It's so impressive.
Yeah, and it comes down to the little decisions. Like, even, like you said, this is 1980s. We're in a time where, like, mental health nowadays isn't really treated seriously enough. And it definitely wasn't you know, 42 years ago. So the fact that we have that, but we also have, I love the fact that we have Mary Tyler Moore's character and her parents having like this stigmatized view towards psychoanalysis and psychotherapy, mm-hmm. and how even when Donald Sutherland's character does end up going to go see the therapist, he's saying, I don't really believe in this. Like, I don't get it. But like, he opens up and it shows how talking to an expert can help in this situation. Mm-hmm. And it's that contrast between the willingness of Donald Sutherland and the unwillingness of Mary Tyler Moore's character that really drives home like this core idea of everyone deals with loss differently, mm-hmm. which is so brilliantly portrayed in this film. Every single character is dealing with this completely differently from the other ones. And there's a solution for everyone. And a lot of the time it's talking to someone who can at least help you understand what that solution is. Because none of these characters are really getting any grand revelation at any time Mm-mm. based on something that's being told to them. They're only getting grand revelations based on things they're saying themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, we see Timothy Hutton come to the realization that he's punishing himself for holding on. You know, I hung on. That's, like, one of my favorite lines ever. I hung on. I mean, it's so simple. There's nothing more to it than that. He hung on. He was too strong. Whatever. And it's those things that you know, that's not a moment that people are going to sit there and you know, it's not the Fenway Park scene from Good Will Hunting, right? It's not. It's not Robin Williams running around doing the home run and Matt Damon getting up and everything, because it's negative. And it's not as memorable. Yet to me, I'll take this, because this is just subtle boom in your face. And we see that realization for him throughout. We see Donald Sutherland starting to realize like what he needs to do. And we see Mary Tyler Moore's wall. She's trying to take it down. And every time she tries to take it down and she gets shunned by her child, she says, well, screw that. I'm not trying again. And then she overreacts in the opposite way. And we just see these different levels of dealing with grief. And then we get just these performance, this side performance, Friedrich Lane, who I love that he's in this, because I always forget that it's him. And then I see it at the end and I'm like, oh, that's the guy who arrests Kate. Good for him. Karen, I'm not sure who plays Karen, and Judd Hirsch, they are all so good and so important to this movie overall. And especially Judd Hirsch, he doesn't even feel like he's acting. Like, it No. doesn't feel like he's acting in this movie. It just feels like he's there. But we need that, because we're seeing all the stages of grief take place at one time. We need somebody who can just say, like, for him, it's not a big deal. He deals with this stuff every day. He talks to people about this stuff every single day and tries to help them through it. He's not looking at this as, yeah, it's a tragedy, but this isn't the end all be all for him, because he sees this every day and how people have to deal with it. It's just an interesting, depressing way to look at that. But that's what this movie is conveying. This is the biggest moment in Timothy Hutton's life. He can't forgive himself for this. And it's Judd Hirsch's job to teach him how to, while also helping him navigate these two parents who have no idea how to handle it, because they don't know how to forgive themselves either.
Yeah, and that's the brilliance behind Judd Hirsch's character, is that he's just like this logical grounding for all of these characters in this film. He's just this sounding board for them, essentially. And he's just there to listen. And one of the most powerful moments in this entire film is when Timothy Hutton goes to Judd Hirsch in the middle of the night after Karen commits suicide. Mm-hmm. And it's just when Judd Hirsch is hugging him and just saying, I'm your friend. Mm-hmm. It's just so powerful to see like this human compassion in this moment, where we're seeing like Mary Tyler Moore has completely abandoned human compassion at this point, because she just can't handle it. She can't connect with anyone. She's so distraught by her loss and her grief that she can't connect with people anymore. And that's really what's driven Timothy Hutton to this point where like he needs this assistance. And seeing him go for that help in that instance and recognizing what he needs when he hears about another loss in his life, it's so powerful. And it really just goes to show that, like, I mean, this is based off a novel, correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It just really goes to show that this story is so grounded in reality that it doesn't need to go for a shock factor moment.
Yeah, it doesn't. It absolutely does not. It has all the drama there. And this is like the hardest thing you can do, though, is how do you pull drama from this? And how much do we see of Buck in this movie, right? Barely anything, but they talk about him and you feel the love for him because that's all they talk about is Buck, 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 Buck. And even Donald said, no, she loved Bucky. I mean, that's her firstborn. You know, there's a different relationship there, all that stuff. But we see the sinking of that boat or the drowning, the overturning of that boat for, I would bet, less than 2 minutes of actual screen time. I would bet it's less than 2 minutes. Yet they create all the drama around it. We don't see a single person attempt suicide in this movie. And yet all of the drama is based around that. We don't see an actual massive blow up between Timothy Hutton and Mary Tyler Moore. We get the weird dog part for sure. That was definitely on the verge of it. And then we get the part where he says, why do you hate me? And those are definitely the moments. And then, but there's still so much tension and drama throughout the rest of it. One of the biggest ones for me, one of the parts for me in this movie that devastates me the most is the swim team stuff. Because the swim team has nothing to do with the fact that they want him on the swim team. The swim team is, once he's off the swim team, the parents now don't have their connection to Buck anymore. They're using him as like a host to they get to go to the swim meets still. You know, it's not going to be Buck, but at least they'll get to go to the swim meets and, like, you know, all that. And when he leaves, it's not the devastation of, that's why Mary Tyler Moore is so much angrier. It's not, and that's why Donald Sutherland, great acting by Donald Sutherland in that scene where he finds out and it's just the dropping of the face. They're not angry at him. They're angry because now it means there is no more of that connection. Buck was all state or whatever. He was so good at swimming, which also makes it all the more heartbreaking that he dies in a swimming accident, like, or in a boating thing, he drowns. So, like, the tension that you can pull from anything, you had to be a freaking good writer, though. And you have got the really good actors. And I think that's one of the things that frustrates me the most when I hear other people talk about movies from, you know, the 70s, 80s, whatever, just any time period, realistically. But I get very frustrated because I always go back to it. People do not appreciate subtle as much as they appreciate in your face. And I'm going to be talking about The Usual Suspects next week. So who the hell am I to talk? I mean, that movie's not subtle at all. It's subtle, yes. But then once, like, the reason that movie's great is for the least subtle reason of all time. So, but everybody, and I think De Niro gives one of the all-time great performances in Raging Bull. They nominated Timothy Hutton for supporting because they didn't think he would beat De Niro. He wouldn't have beaten De Niro. But if he did beat De Niro, people would say, oh, it was a crime, it was a sham, blah, blah, blah. It wouldn't have been.
No.
It wouldn't have been. But Robert De Niro is a hell of a lot more famous than Timothy Hutton. And Robert De Niro's performance is a lot more in your face than Timothy Hutton's. Martin Scorsese is a lot more famous now, especially as a director, than Redford ever became as a director. And he's a lot less subtle. Subtlety is the key, though. And that's why I've never seen Coal Miner's Daughter. Sissy Spacek better be pretty freaking good if she beat Mary Tyler Moore for this. Because Mary Tyler Moore was a comedian. The Mary Tyler Moore Show is a comedy. And she comes out and gives one of the great dramatic performances of all time in this movie. Donald Sutherland wasn't nominated for this. Like, because it's subtle. But it wins Best Screenplay, it wins Best Director, and it wins Best Picture. You tell me it can do all of that without having Donald Sutherland nominated for Best Actor? You've got to be kidding me. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. All of that is to say, I just wish that there was a way to entice people to appreciate the subtle more. Because a movie like Ordinary People, it gets talked about as if it's been seen. But in reality, it hasn't been seen. And I always make this argument with Shakespeare in Love. Show me a person who's seen, show me a person who hates Shakespeare in Love, I'll show you a person who hasn't seen it. Because even you, who didn't really love it, you still liked it. Like, you still said it was fine. Yep. Like, that's what I mean. Show me a person who hates this movie, they haven't seen it. And I know, like, Jordan Alford is one of our biggest listeners. He gave it 3.5 stars out of 5. But he doesn't hate it. The way people talk about this movie, who haven't seen it, they talk about it like it's despicable. I wish that we could find a way to get people to appreciate The Subtle more, because that's when filmmaking's at its absolute finest. And that's why Ordinary People, to me, this movie, man, I don't know, because obviously we're going to have Usual Suspects. I watched Usual Suspects like 3 months ago, 4 months ago. This is jumping The Usual Suspects. This is going to keep going, going, going for me. This is kind of like A Single Man, where I'm like, hey, when I make my next top 100 list, it's just going to be kind of the mood I'm in. And this could go very, very high on my list. I think it's a masterpiece.
It's this masterclass on the construction of a film, on narrative, on subtlety. Like, that's just what it comes down to. The fact that the best decision with this story is setting it so far removed from the tragedy itself. Mm-hmm. Because then it's leading the audience to realize that there's lasting impact of these things. Months. And like, this is months. Like, these people are going to go on like this probably for many more months after this too. Like, this isn't something that's just like being resolved at the end of this film. And that's what I also really appreciate about the end of the film, of having Mary Tyler Moore leave and Donald Sutherland just saying, yeah, she's gone to Houston.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean it's over.
No. And it's just, there's no closure. Mm-hmm. And that's because there is no closure. You experience a loss like this, there's never any closure for it. It is something that haunts you forever. And it's just how you respond to it and how you keep going. And that's what this film's really showing. It's like, Timothy Hutton's character is taught when he's talking about quitting the swim team, it's like, it's not going to look good. And Judd Hirsch is just like, forget how it looks. How does it feel? And like, mm-hmm. that's the thing that anyone who experiences loss has to keep asking. It's like, how does it feel? And like, it doesn't matter what other people are thinking about how you feel, because you have to take care of yourself first and foremost in these situations.
And it's not even about loss. That's just like the best life advice you can possibly give, because so many people are so worried about everything else. And I talk about that all the time, but it just, you know, it's crazy. I remember, though, I mean, from personal experience, obviously not to the level of you, because I wasn't as close to the person, but one of my friends died 10 years ago, and it was a larger than life character like this. 27 days before his 21st birthday dies. He was a lineman, like brutal. Mm-hmm. And he had a younger brother who was like 2 years younger, wasn't that type of personality. But I remember how like the entire town, because of how big of a personality his brother was and how popular and everything, the entire town is like rallying. How do we how do we try to make everybody feel better? And like, I only saw it from the perspective of the characters around Frederick Lean. You know what I mean? Where it's like, we're doing everything we can. You know what I mean? But at the same time, it's Frederick Lean is trying to be with him because it's like, you make me feel like he's still here. And then you have Timothy Hutton who like, you are too hard to be around. And it's not you. It's just, I can't be around you because of this. And when you experience that firsthand, and I think like setting this in, you know, it's in outside of Chicago, but you're getting that suburb, closer family type community. Those are always the ones where this is more devastating, or it feels more devastating, because mm-hmm. there is so much interaction. You don't set this in Los Angeles or in New York City or in something, like, you have to set this in the suburbs. Because these are kids who are just going to school, they're coming back, and how do they deal with it? What was Frederick Lean's life like when he's going home? He's not the family, but how's he feeling? A lot that goes into it, and it's just it's always compelling. That's the craziest part about it. It's just always compelling, and I don't know, man. They just don't make movies like this. They have a hard time, and I don't know if we've ever seen a movie that deals with mental health to this level. I would say if anybody's looking for another movie that handles mental health in just an absolutely ridiculous, ridiculously realistic fashion, but in a much different way, check out the movie Christine with Rebecca Hall. Very unseen. Had Michael C. Hall as well. And she plays a news reporter who, it's based on a true story, news reporter kills herself on air. Literally shoots herself in the head on air. The depiction of Christine and Rebecca Hall's performance are second to none. She didn't get nominated that year because nobody wanted to watch the movie because it's depressing. But that's another movie that deals with this, but when there's no support system. This movie has a support system. That movie doesn't have a support system. And it's a tough watch, but I don't know if they can't make movies like this. They try, but then they always try to go the Goodwill Hunting route rather than this route. There's only one Goodwill Hunting. The reason that Goodwill Hunting works is because for all its cheesiness, it just makes you feel good. And Robin Williams is great, and Matt Damon's great, and Ben Affleck's great, and Minnie Driver's great, and you're just like, man, I could live in this. The reason every movie that tries to be that sucks is because they're just cheesy, and they're copying something that was very cheesy but worked because it's the best it's been done and the first time it's been done. Mm-hmm. If you try to do this and you can manage it, you're going to do a lot better. But I don't think – what director could possibly pull this off? Like, seriously, it's so hard to figure out who could actually do that.
It is, but we're still closer to something like this being made than something like Good Will Hunting.
Agreed. I do agree with that, yeah.
But, yeah, it's just – it's a shame there aren't more movies like this, because I feel like if there were more movies like this, the stigma around mental health would dissipate way faster. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. But people would rather say this one stinks. Let's go look at, you know, something else. And then, you know, it's also not, if it was more compelling subject matter for people.
Also a very depressing movie.
Yeah, that's what's hurting it too, is people aren't going to seek this one out. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's tough. But all right, man, you got anything else you want to say about Ordinary People, or should we move on to better and happier things?
No, let's go on to some happier things.
All right, so I didn't watch any other movies this week other than Ordinary People and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So what's the best thing you watched this week? And I'll tell you, if you can tell me the movies you watched, I'll tell you which one I like the most out of all of them.
Okay, I watched – what did I watch? I watched 2011's The Thing.
Okay, didn't see that. Don't plan on it.
Wasn't great. I watched Training Day.
I haven't seen that, actually. I don't know how I haven't seen it.
Honestly – I thought it was a little overhyped, but it's fine.
Yeah.
And then I watched Looper.
Love Looper.
And Looper is a phenomenal. It is so close to being a perfect film. Emily Blunt's performance is probably one of her weakest performances she's ever given. But everything outside of that, this film is so good. Rian Johnson is so underrated still. I feel like not enough people have seen Looper. Not enough people are going to go see Looper because everyone hates The Last Jedi.
Hmm.
Watch Looper, because this just goes to show how good of a director Rian Johnson is. Performances by Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis are phenomenal. Not to mention the child actor in that movie is so good.
Yeah. That's a great movie, man. I love Looper. I haven't seen Looper in a while. I remember when that came out, man. That movie blew my mind, and it actually nailed it. That's 10 years old now. That movie nailed it, though. Like,
yes,
just the whole time travel thing and everything like that. Like, it just worked. And I don't know, man. That is one that people should check out more. I remember when that came out, that was kind of one of those movies where people were like, man, this should get some like awards hype, even though it's an action sci-fi movie. So entertaining, such an interesting concept. And it just nails the world building and great performances. You're not kidding. Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are great. Paul Dano in a nice small role, he's great. Jeff Daniels in a small role, he's great. That's a great movie. I like that movie a lot. So I gotta check that out again. Yeah. It's been too long.
But what's your top? That's all I watched this week.
Was that your favorite?
Looper was by far the best movie I watched.
Okay, got it. So I took your thunder. I talked about it more positively than you could. All right, let's jump into Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It was my number 86, but it's your number 37, so you get to intro it.
It is, and honestly, number 37 might not be high enough for this. This is by far like my second favorite Tarantino film. I think what Tarantino has established over the years, especially like once Inglourious Basterds came out and then Django Unchained, he has this way of creating alternative timelines in a way that no one else can. And what Once Upon a Hollywood does that shouldn't be possible, it has a film that takes place on August 8th, 1969 with Sharon Tate as a character in it. And you don't know if she's going to die or not.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't be possible. This type of film should not be possible. But Tarantino was able to do it. The dialogue in this film is absolutely incredible. The look at Hollywood, like this waning era of Hollywood as we're getting into the 70s here, is absolutely fascinating. DiCaprio and Pitt give astounding performances in the two lead roles in this. And it just, it captures everything about two people getting to the end of their rope and just having to accept that.
Yeah, I think, I don't remember exactly what the line is that DiCaprio says, but it's when he's talking to the child actress and he says, pretty soon you'll be living it. And he's like talking about how, like, you know, it's all over. Like, you know, one day you wake up and you're a has-been or something. And when he's talking to Brad Pitt, and he says, like, my career's over, whatever. It's what's so crazy about something like Hollywood, right? The film industry in general, it's 100 years old. That's it. I mean, if you really think about it, it's a little bit older than 100, but not much. People weren't, you know, you weren't super famous and super wealthy just because you were in The Birth of a Nation or Intolerance or something like that. Like that started to come up a little bit later. Once this really started to become like a massive money-making enterprise, and it's so young. And at the end of the day, almost every single person who has been involved in Hollywood has either, you know, it's the whole Dark Knight thing. They've either died the hero or they've lived long enough to see themselves become the villain. Like you think about James Dean, icon, made 3 movies, dies at 27. Then you have somebody like Kevin Spacey, icon, turns out he's a pedophile. Like you have all of these things that happen throughout time. Then you have the less extreme ones, but still, just look at who's hot and who's not. And all of a sudden, somebody's at the peak of their career. You think it's never going to stop, and it always stops. It always ends at some point. Somebody always makes a shit movie, or somebody always gets old. That's the thing. You always age. The one thing you can't stop, even in Hollywood, is aging. Look at Nicole Kidman in The Northman. She doesn't look like a normal person at this point. Like, she's trying to stop aging with Botox, but I'm sorry. Like, it's just like, it's so much. It's crazy. And you can just tell, like, that's not what Nicole Kidman should look like at this point. But whatever. That's their choice. I don't care. I'm just saying there's this obsession to get into it. There's this obsession to be a part of it, even for writers, directors, producers. It doesn't matter what it is. Everybody wants to work in show business. That's it. They just want to work in show business. And so many of the stories about show business end with absolute tragedy, or they just end with you becoming irrelevant. And this movie looks at that in such a unique way where when Brad Pitt says to him, I never really had much of a career to speak of, so it doesn't really matter to me. And Leonardo DiCaprio is having this breakdown. And yet it's still, okay, but can I get that one more hit? Can I get that one more? I'm going to go out to Italy. I'm going to make 6 months of movies, and I'm going to become somebody. Because it's like it's a sickness. You can't stop. You just keep going. And I think it's a fascinating look at that. But what is most impressive about this movie, and it's one of my favorite things in movies, and I've talked about it a little bit, but we saw Richard Linklater and Everybody Wants Him. We're seeing with this, when you can take a movie and make it about something that people understand, whether that is the first day of college and going into college, and you make it about the 3 days before college where this guy doesn't know what he's going for. He's heard all the stories, but he doesn't know what he's really getting into. Or you make a movie that's all about the buildup to Sharon Tate and one of the dead. It is probably the most brutal murder in American history. Definitely the most infamous murder in American history. It's devastating. It's the reason the Mansons are on the map. It's the reason why, you know, Roman Polanski lost his freaking mind. I mean, it's insane. And the whole movie, they don't know it's coming. They don't know that they're about to be a part of something that massive. They don't know. They can't know. And that is what I love so much about this movie, because how tomorrow you could get murdered. You don't know. I don't know if you're gonna leave your house, so hopefully nobody breaks in, but you don't know. And Sharon Tate on August 7th didn't know she was gonna be murdered around midnight on August 8th. And on August 8th, she didn't know she was gonna be murdered. When they're sitting at El Coyote, they don't know that they're all gonna die that night. And Tarantino makes it about the nonsense before that. It's just, it is like Ordinary People. This is about normal people in Hollywood. Now, what you want to say as a normal person in Hollywood, this is pretty much it. Just kind of going around doing your thing, whatever. And then to spin it on its head and subvert our expectations, because of course, called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So it's a fairy tale, and not kill them and have them get their asses kicked, just like he kicks the shit out of Hitler in Inglourious Basterds. The line that gets me the most is when J.C. Sebring walks down the driveway and says the line, So I forget exactly what it is, but it's something along those, like, hey man, what the hell happened here? Jay Sebring never got to utter those words because Jay Sebring was murdered that night. Yep. And Tarantino is taking a look ahead of, like, what would have happened if Jay Sebring and Sharon Tate weren't killed that night and they just got to keep going and everything just went on normal. And he doesn't go, he doesn't delve into that. He could have made the whole movie about that, but he doesn't delve into that. It's just that little interaction. It comes up. Oh my God, that's crazy. I can't believe that happened. She's talking about her own murder, but it never happened. It's just a fascinating look at that. And I'll let you go because I've talked too much.
No, it is a fascinating look. And it's because Tarantino's not afraid to confront history and change it. And that's what's so brilliant about him. Is like, people love Tarantino for quite a few things. They like the hyperviolence he presents in films. They like the dialect he provides and the insight he provides into, I mean, a lot of, like, if we're looking into a lot of his works, a lot of it's about aging. And this is no different than that. The irony in Rick Dalton not wanting to go to Rome to film spaghetti westerns, when you and I, as viewers, understand how prolific spaghetti westerns do end up becoming after this, it's fascinating to see how these different opinions of these characters feel so different than us as an audience because we have that dramatic irony attached to it.
Yeah.
And then and then Tarantino plays on that dramatic irony by flipping it on its head by not murdering Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring and everything at the end of the film.
Yeah. And I think, like, that's what's great about this. So I always look at it as, like, Richard Linklater, we just talked about Before Sunset a couple weeks ago, and Quentin Tarantino. You said a lot of Quentin Tarantino's movies are about aging. His movies are just about time. You know what I mean? Like, Pulp Fiction, probably the greatest depiction of time maybe ever in a movie because of the way he does it and jumps around, and you don't know when is this and when is that, and it just feels like it's linear and then it's not. And then you're like, wait, what is that? This watch, it's all about time. Everything is about time. But they do it in such different ways. But this was Quentin Tarantino making a Richard Linklater movie until the final 20 minutes of the movie. Everything before that is how Richard Linklater would make. If they said, Richard, go make a movie about the Sharon Tate murders, this is what he would do. And then it's the last 20 minutes. Because ultimately, it's just about time. The song that plays when they get back on August 8th is Out of Time by the Rolling Stones. Baby, you're out of time. It's a great scene in the movie. I think the song is awesome in the movie. It makes me want to listen to it. And I've listened to it like three times now in the last like 4 days. And I'm tired of it because it just keeps repeating out of time, out of time, out of time. It's the same line over and over again. But it works so well in this movie. And it is such a great example of Tarantino just going a little bit beyond. But this movie is all about time. It's about, you know, Sharon Tate is kind of locked in time. For Sharon Tate, this is all she will be really known for. Has anybody seen The Wrecking Crew? I don't know. But this is what she's going to be known for. And we know that it sets in motion, like, the dramatic irony of Roman Polanski. We know what happens to Roman Polanski. We know what ultimately becomes of Roman Polanski. And you're adding in these two not real characters who are living next door, or one who's living next door and the other just keeps coming. And you're having them go through everything that's happening in Hollywood at this time. But they weren't there to save the day. While everything else was happening, Squeaky is a real person, Flower Child's a real person, the Spahn Ranch is a real thing. Obviously, we know Charles Manson's real. Like, all of that stuff is real. And I think Tarantino does a great job of subverting our expectations in more ways than one in this movie, where it's not just the murder of Sharon Tate, but it's also the way he subverts our expectations with what you think he's going to make this movie. You know that you knew the Manson family was involved in it. That was discussed prior to it. You knew it was Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio. I mean, Brad Pitt's in maybe the most violent of all of Tarantino's movies, which is Inglourious Basterds. It's a very violent movie. You know all that's coming. And then you know that Margot Robbie's in it. And yet Margot Robbie, Rick Dalton, and Cliff Booth never talk in this movie until the very end. In fact, Cliff Booth and Sharon Tate never talk in this movie. I don't even think they're on screen at the same time. They're never there. And it subverted our expectations in what we thought the story was going to be. And it doesn't add in the unnecessary violence that Tarantino could have added in with the Manson family or anything like that. When Brad Pitt is walking through the Spahn Ranch the whole time, I remember the first time I was like, he's dead. he's going to get killed because it's Tarantino. Tarantino instead decided to create suspense and then have, because Cliff Booth might be the coolest character Quentin Tarantino has ever written, have him just get out of it and do it in his really badass way. It's a brilliant decision because that subverts our expectations for what we expect to actually happen with a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah, you raise a good point where, yes, we do get a bit of hyperviolence at the end of this film in the last 20 minutes, but like, even for Tarantino, it's pretty dialed back compared to some of his other works. And it really just goes to show that Tarantino is one of the best directors of the last three decades, and that he does have this he has this breadth to him that, you know, not many people can match, where he is known for something. And I do believe this is why I like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood so much, is because it is different and distinct from Tarantino's other films while still being distinctly Tarantino.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good description of it, because like I still put Bastards and Pulp Fiction ahead of it for sure. But I do agree. This is probably the most distinct Quentin Tarantino movie. It really is. I mean, obviously the Kill Bills are pretty distinct too, because, you know, they get into the whole samurai thing, but this is a very distinct movie. It's very different. And, it's not what you expect from him. He builds these, he's always had good characters. Like, there's no denying that, but the way he builds Rick Dalton out and Cliff Booth and shows their desperation of both of them, or really Cliff Booth, the way he's willing to just be like, you know what, man, this is the hand I was dealt. This is the hand I was dealt, whatever, doesn't matter. But Rick Dalton just turning into a baby, like losing it because he's got nothing left. And then Sharon Tate, to create this like idealistic view of Sharon Tate, but that may have been what Sharon Tate was doing the whole time. She's running around doing whatever she's got to do. And, you know, happy to see herself on screen, not knowing in 6 months, she's going to be murdered in a terribly grisly way. It's great. I mean, it's absolutely great. And I don't know. It's funny because so many Tarantino is probably the most ripped off director in the history of Hollywood. How are people going to rip this one off? That's the question. Like, cause obviously then we had the COVID year. And so things have kind of been pushed around and everything. This is very popular, nominated for a lot of Oscars, wins Best Supporting Actor. Do you think people are going to try to rip this one off and kind of like make these glamorized versions of 1960s Hollywood, or no?
I don't. Even when this movie came out, it felt like these glamorizations of 1960s Hollywood were kind of a thing of the past. The fact that Tarantino was doing this film in the first place felt outdated at the time. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think maybe the COVID years actually make it so that we don't get that, because people have more time to sit on this movie and realize that they can't make something like it.
So you hope, right? Hopefully. Because I just don't know how you would do it. Alex Wright says here, I was looking at the comments here. It was like showing two entirely different stories connect and intersect. The innocence about Sharon Tate, the whole movie, is great. I don't think Sharon Tate says a word in this movie until almost an hour in. And Margot Robbie was hot at this point. Like, she was in The Wolf of Wall Street. She'd been in I, Tonya. Like, she was in a lot. Like, she was not just some, like, Margot Robbie is up there on that billboard for a reason alongside Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt. And she barely does anything for so long in this movie, but they do. They keep like this, not knowing what's going on in her life, I almost think is better. We get the Steve McQueen scene where Damian Lewis brilliantly plays Steve McQueen. I love scene at the Playboy Mansion. So good. And we get him talking about, you know, I never had a chance, whatever. Like, it's no big deal. Like, whatever. But it also puts that question in her head, like, was she still sleeping with J.C. Sebring? Like, how were Herman Roman Polanski? She's just doing it kind of for like the, I'm going to work my way into movies or whatever it was. But like, we never lose that pureness to her that it feels like this Hollywood starlet who's just running around, having a great time, has money, doesn't have to worry about anything, and just gets little bit parts here and there, is super good looking. That's all that mattered. Like, I like that a lot because I don't know that much about Sharon Tate, and I don't think that many people do. I think they just really know about the murder. You know a lot about everything else, though, from 1969 Hollywood. You know a lot about, obviously everybody knows about the Manson family, but you know a lot about all of the other things that were going on, like you said earlier, with the spaghetti westerns and everything. I think it's nice to just kind of have this whatever version of Sharon Tate, and we just sit there and we just take it in.
Yeah, it feels like a time capsule. almost. Because, like, when we look back at Sherry Tate, we want this idealistic version of her, right? Like, we don't know the ins and outs of her relationship with Roman Polanski or anything like that, but we know that she was an up-and-coming starlet who was murdered and, like, didn't have a chance to break out because of it. Uh-huh. So you get this idealistic version of it, which is what Tarantino's really excelling at here. Tarantino's so good at building characters in a way where they're archetypical, but still kind of stray far enough from expectation that they just remain so engaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, what do we think about... So one of the things I love about this movie is the music choices. Tarantino's always been great with music. There's no denying that. Yes. I mean, since Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, he's just been doing it. He's been killing it. He just knows how to use music in movies. What do you think about, like, the choices he made? Because obviously this is such a massive, massively infamous period of time. But he still managed to find, like, some, like, really hidden gems for a lot of these things. Mm-hmm. How do you think this all adds to kind of, like, the personality of these characters? You know what I mean? Like, I'm just thinking because, like, we see, like, all this, like, dancey kind of, like, upbeat stuff. And, like, that is just adding so much to the dread that's coming. But it's also letting us sit there with, like, our guard down the entire time. I just think it's very interesting. He doesn't play any, like, depressing music. That doesn't happen.
There's one instance where there is some music that's, like, super creepy. And it's when we first see the Manson family. And, like, the girls are walking and they're singing that really creepy song.
That's a good point. That part is terrifying.
It's absolutely terrifying. I forgot how terrifying that was until I rewatched the movie. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is terrifying and totally sets it up so you, like, that little creepy song is enough foreshadowing to build all of the tension at the Spawn Ranch.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's wild how such a small detail you forget is even in the movie when you think about the movie later has that much of a impact on tone in the film.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it kind of creates a creepiness around Margaret Qualley, who gives a phenomenal performance in this, and anybody who's a Leftovers fan, she's great in that. But she is so good in this movie, and she's just so gross. And you know, Brad Pitt keeps on, like, doing all that, and it just—he's somehow managing with the music that's playing, with Brad Pitt's kind of just carefree attitude towards everything. He's managing to capture that carefree attitude of the 1960s, when we also know that it's kind of like one of the most dangerous time periods ever, like, in this nation, because you had so many mass murderers, serial killers who were going around doing everything. And it leads to that, like, what kind of trouble is he going to get in with this girl? And I think that's why, like you said, it's so powerful when he finally gets to the Spawn Ranch. But I always love when filmmakers are able to do this. He's doing all this and creating all this suspense while playing mostly upbeat music. Yeah, the part where they're humming the song is terrifying. But, like, Brad Pitt's never listening to a sad song. Nope. He's always listening to upbeat 1960s stuff. And it's offsetting everything. Sharon Tate's always dancing to the 1960s upbeat stuff. Leonardo DiCaprio's sitting in the pool listening to upbeat 1960s stuff while his house is about to be, like, infiltrated. And you think that people are going to get murdered. Like, I just love those decisions, and I just think Tarantino has such a knack for that, and just using, I mean, his use of music, his use of voiceover, like, we have so many breaks in the fourth wall in this movie just for, like, what feels like no reason, Kurt Russell narrating things, like, whatever. But I just love how it adds up to create the feel of the movie, and that's why I just wanted to bring that up while you're talking about the characters and everything like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, how are the characters influenced by the music or the lack of music in certain parts of this, and how that elevates it?
I think one of the big things to notice is that, like, this time period itself and Hollywood itself at this time is a character in this film.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the big important thing, where Tarantino doesn't just provide a setting in this film. He wants to really create this late 1960s Hollywood as something that's interacting and influencing all of these characters at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and using your setting as another character is just, it's so hard to do, but when you can do it, it works. And this, you can't make a Hollywood 1960s movie that doesn't have the setting as a character. It won't work. Like, you know, if you're going to set it in 1960s Hollywood, there's expectations that need to be met. I would say, like, this was probably the bravest movie that Quentin Tarantino ever made. Because there's so many, like, when he sits down and makes The Hateful Eight, there's no expectation. I know that that's probably his least liked movie, but there's no expectation. Reservoir Dogs, there was no expectation. Pulp Fiction, there was no expectation. Kill Bill movies, like, there was no... This movie, there's an expectation. And when he was talking about, you know, we're going to make Hollywood and we're going to make it look like the 60s again with the neon and blah, blah, blah. Everybody who works in film has been to Hollywood or has been in Hollywood or has their own take on Hollywood. And they might not have been there in the 60s, but they sure do know the idealized version of what it was like in the 1960s. This is a ballsy movie to make as late in his career as he is. Mm-hmm. And to do it so successfully, you know, that's just a nod to him because, man, he could have really butchered this one, but he didn't. And, you know, a lot of that's the acting. It's a who's who of Hollywood in this movie, but still.
I mean, to be fair, he's already worked with all of these actors before, though.
Yeah.
Like, these aren't people he's just, like, bringing in because they're the hotness, like, other than Margot Robbie, right? Like, he's worked with Leo at this point. He's worked with Brad Pitt. He's had Kurt Russell in his films before. Like, these are people who have worked with Tarantino over the years. And it's just the fact that he has that type of connection with these people that he can bring them in. And we get, like, this is easily Brad Pitt's best performance of his career.
See, I go, this is easily Leonardo DiCaprio's best performance of his career. Ooh. And I think that this is one of the best performances of Brad Pitt's career. I think Brad Pitt has a lot of very underrated roles. I think 12 Monkeys is a great role. I think his role in The Tree of Life is phenomenal. I know you laugh at me for that, but I think that is just like the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, I think Brad Pitt has a couple more. I think Leo, they started kind of nominating for stuff and throwing into stuff because he was a little more vocal about like not winning Oscars. Yeah. Because not for nothing, he was the A-lister, never invited to the party essentially at one point until he won for The Revenant. This blows the Revenant out of the water. He's not even close. Like, it blows the Revenant out of the freaking water.
Yeah, his performance in this is top notch. Like I said, it perfectly captures that idea of like a fading star just like coming to terms with that. And the fact that we get to the end of this movie and he's completely reborn, because all of a sudden it's that moment when he's just recognized at the end. It's like, oh, wait. You're Rick Dalton, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And like the fact that the movie ends on that, it's just like, oh, Rick Dalton's career can just completely go only up from here at this point. Because not to mention the fact that like literally was just the target of a one of the greatest murder cults in history.
Yeah.
But everything about it, right? Like Rick Dalton's going to play Rick Dalton in the movie of this night.
Mm-hmm. And the whole thing of like that goes back to what I said at the beginning of this discussion about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You always know that you're going to become irrelevant at some point.
Yep.
But that feeling for him, it's like, man, I'm not done yet. Mm-mm, I'm back, baby. What does he say? I'm back, baby. I'm back. You know, like it's not over. Yeah, you're married now. You know, you've been out to Italy. Like you've done all this stuff. It's funny how. One person saying, hey, I recognize you. And he also friends with Polanski. I'm sitting next to the hottest director in Hollywood right now. He made Rosemary's freaking Baby. Like, you never know. And I think that's the beauty of Hollywood. The line that he keeps saying in this of, if you own real estate in Hollywood, you live here. Yes. You don't rent because then you don't live here. You know, that was always a big thing. That is a big thing in Hollywood because if you live in Hollywood, you're part of it. If you're an actor and you live in Hollywood, you're an actor in Hollywood. Like you are halfway there, even if you're not super successful. And it's just that it's your ground. He's grounded in this Hollywood thing. And, you know, at the beginning, I'm talking about how they're so scared of becoming irrelevant and all of that, but you know, it's coming, but it's the obsession. Never leave because you never know what can happen. And I think that's the fairy tale aspect of Hollywood is you never know what can happen. And I'll tell you what, go out there right now. Doesn't look very nice. It's not very pretty. There's a lot of traffic. There's a lot of homeless people. Rent's insanely expensive. A lot of needles on the beaches. Not great. It's not a great place at all. But there's still that idea if you're there, like, hey, this could happen. Who knows?
Yeah.
It could happen. You could run into somebody and all of a sudden it's your big break. It's that fantasy element of it. In this movie, the fantasy element of it is the Manson family ran into Cliff Booth, and Cliff Booth made sure that they died.
And that is how Tarantino plays on time so well in this, is that it's that single change in the narrative that changes everything, right? Like, mm-hmm. the moment in this case, it's the fact that Rick Dalton goes out into the driveway to confront the people in the car, and then they're like, let's go punish the people who taught us to be violent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, it completely changes the entire narrative of like what they're doing. They were sent there on a mission to kill the people inhabiting this one house. But because they saw Rick Dalton, they completely changed their objective in the night. Mm-hmm. And it's that butterfly effect that Tarantino's playing with here. It's the same thing he did with Inglourious Basterds, and why the ending of Inglourious Basterds works so well. He understands the small details needed to change in order to change history.
Yeah. Yeah. And it works. You know, we know that nobody ran out with a margarita and a bathrobe screaming at them to turn their hippie hunk of junk and turn it around and all that. We know that didn't happen.
Yeah.
But once it does happen, now everything's off. What mm-hmm. happens next? It's all thrown off just a little bit, and now it's going to keep going. Yeah, I mean, it's so great. And yeah, Brad Pitt's performance is phenomenal. You know, when at the end there, when he's talking to them, and no, it was something dumber than that or something stupider than that, whatever he says, great line. But I mean, in terms of the thing with Tarantino movies is they're all so freaking entertaining. Like all of them, even his not good one. The only thing that's not entertaining is Death Proof. Death Proof stinks, in my opinion. I think it's so boring.
It's fun.
I don't like it. I see. I don't find it fun. I just think they talk too much. Like, shut up and get this.
There's a lot of talking in that movie.
Especially if you watch it as the double feature Grindhouse, like as it was supposed to be. Planet Terror is so freaking entertaining. And then you're like, okay, where's the excitement? Like, what's going to happen? But it's hard to say, like, this is the one that I would watch the most. But this and Pulp Fiction are the two where, like, give me a scene and I'll just be like, oh, cool. It's on. I'm going to watch the scene and then I'll change the channel. And I'm probably going to be flicking back. You know, when Edmonton and Calgary are playing for the Battle of Alberta tonight, if Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was on a channel, I might be watching that a little bit more than the Battle for Alberta.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I'll linger a little bit. I'm sure nothing happened in those couple minutes because I want to see how this scene is going to play out. I forget how this goes. That's the power of Quentin Tarantino. That's the power of a movie like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And good luck making a movie about Hollywood's golden, you know, second golden era quite like this. I don't, you know, quite as good as this. I don't know if it's going to happen for a very long time. And hopefully Tarantino continues to build off of it, and whatever he makes next ends up actually being his Oscar winner, because he's been so close so many times. He just always loses to something that's either a little bit better or just a little bit more popular.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. We're done.
That's it. Yep.
Cool. All right, guys, we got one more week and then we take a big 4-week hiatus. Next week, we are going to be talking about The Usual Suspects from 1995. And Seven Samurai from 1954, which is replacing John's Fellowship of the Ring from 2001, because I got that all the way up in my top 10. So we won't be talking about Fellowship of the Ring for a little bit longer, but we will be talking about Seven Samurai. So get your 4 hours of patience out and sit down and watch it. And The Usual Suspects, two movies that I've really wanted to see Seven Samurai for a long time, and I always enjoy watching The Usual Suspects. And then we got a 4-week break because we're going to be out pretty much the whole month of June, and then we're back. We're going to be podcasting on Monday, so that's May 23rd. So tune in then, because we're not going to be podcasting on Survivor Finale night because I'd like to go to bed that night. So that's it. Thank you all for listening. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time.